As a society, we spend a lot of time talking about what it means to live a good life. But when it comes to talking about having a good death, it can be a whole different story. Conversations about end-of-life issues can be some of the most difficult to have, to the point where some of us would rather not talk about it at all. And maybe that's why there's often a disconnect between what we want for our own deaths and what actually happens. Our next guest wants to change that conversation and help us and our loved ones to define our priorities for the end of our lives. That can mean laying out specific steps for determining when further medical care is needed and when it isn't. Dr. Samuel Harrington practiced internal medicine and gastroenterology for more than 30 years in Washington, D.C. He grew up in Milwaukee and is a graduate of the UW Medical School. His new book is At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Dr. Harrington, thanks so much for joining us today.
So, Rob, thank you very much for having me, and please call me Sam.
And so, Sam, what accounts for that disparity between how a lot of us think we might want to pass away, at home preferably, quietly, versus how many of us do after long series of medical procedures?
Well, it's usually because families don't have enough conversation on the subject, and families don't really understand what their loved ones want. And combine that with the fact that the default position in American medicine is to treat and frequently over-treat, and we end up with elderly patients who die in hospitals when they would prefer to die at home. I think it's appropriate to say that 80 or 90% of elderly patients would express the preference, or in medical studies, they express a preference to die quietly at home, but 60% of them die in institutions because of the lack of this conversation.
Quoting from your book here, it's the duty of the physician to sustain life and relieve suffering. And Sam, I think a lot of times those go hand in hand. It's the same thing in many conditions. But when we're talking about end-of-life care, sometimes relieving suffering and sustaining life are opposites.
That is correct. They are. They frequently at the end of life sustain at the end of life, sustaining life and relieving suffering are in conflict, and it is at that point that the patient or their family member has to indicate to the physician what they want done, because in principle, if we give pain medicine to control pain, we might shorten that person's life. I think in practice, we don't really shorten their life by much, but or that concept is a little bit overblown. But it is very important to recognize when that conflict is evident, and then we have to follow the patient's wishes.
You've dealt with these issues to some extent as a doctor through your career, but you start your book on the shores of Lake Michigan talking about your father and how he approached some of these issues. Can you tell his story a little bit for us?
Well, I was toying with the idea of writing the book on this subject, but it didn't crystallize until a conversation I had with my father about potentially repairing an aortic aneurysm in his abdomen. That's a ballooned blood vessel that was threatening to rupture. And he was a lawyer in Milwaukee, and he knew from experience with a client that if it ruptured, he would be unlikely to survive the surgery, emergency surgery. He was 88 at the time we had this conversation. But I had outlined a plan where he could have the aneurysm strengthened without a major surgery, sort of like a giant cardiac catheterization for his aneurysm. And it seemed like a very good plan because it would add several years to his life, and I wanted him alive to meet my grandchildren. And he looked at me, and he kind of clenched his jaw and pointed his finger and asked me, why would I want to treat something that is going to carry me away the way that I want to go, meaning quickly and decisively? And that's when I realized that it's fundamental that if you don't want to die in a hospital, you have to say no to hospitalization. And although his vision was somewhat, I'd say, naive, it was and relied on a random event, the rupture of his aneurysm, it was hugely informative to me and my sisters to, in terms of understanding his mindset. And from that point, that was a jumping off point for other discussions about end of life wishes. I think of having a vision is extremely important, and sharing it is critical.
Talking to Dr. Sam Harrington, his new book is At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Sam, we're all going to deal with these issues one way or another. We hopefully will grow old ourselves. We'll have loved ones who come to this situation. This is going to be a conflict in everyone's lives. Why don't we talk about it more?
Well, it's simply very difficult. Even in my family, where we had multiple discussions, it's just hard to face the facts, and it's hard to speculate on how our life will end. So all the conversations that I had with my parents were always emotionally charged, and I was familiar with them through decades of clinical practice. It's just very, very hard, and it's easier to ignore them. I say people should blunder forward with these conversations, because the consequences of ignoring them are that we end up having our loved ones die in a hospital, frequently in the intensive care unit.
A lot of your book centers around practical advice for families, family members, seniors themselves, people dealing with chronic health conditions. What's your advice for starting that family conversation?
I think it is to take a throwaway line like the vision that I just mentioned, my father's vision or someone else's vision, and expand on it. For example, Groucho Marx famously said that he planned to live forever or die trying. Well, that's a vision. He's gonna fight forever, and that's fine. It's a good point of view, but he's going to end up in the intensive care unit. Or Woody Allen, who said, "I'm not afraid to die. I just don't want to be there when it happens." Well, I was sort of like my father's throwaway line that he hoped to wake up dead. That's a vision, and you can work with that. And if I think that sometimes people say things that we don't think of as end of life comments, but we can turn them into end of life comments. It might be related to what an aunt or uncle endured in terms of treatment or hospitalization. It might be what a friend endured, or et cetera. So you have to sort of look for opportunities, and then you have to seize them.
One of the most emotional parts of this, I think, for a lot of families is when somebody's facing a serious condition, especially late in life, like, say, cancer or heart disease, and there's an aggressive treatment option that could reduce their quality of life. There's the idea that if you don't take all paths, if you don't pursue that aggressive treatment, you're giving up. And you write in your book, accepting death does not mean wanting to die. How do we take that giving up emotion out of the conversation?
Well, we have to recognize that going home to hospice care or palliative care is not giving up. It's embracing a different perspective, and we have to encourage that. False hope is a complication of futile treatment, and we have to avoid that. When my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, of course, we were sad, and we did not want her to give up, but we didn't want her to focus exclusively on prolonging her life. We wanted her to focus on getting to my daughter's wedding, which was about 4 or 5 months later after the diagnosis. So I advise patients to change their perspectives, look for something positive, and then go for that rather than try to fight to prolong their life, because that will ultimately fail.
We're talking right now with Dr. Samuel Harrington about planning for the end of our lives and what it means to choose a good death after a long life. He's the author of the new book, At Peace. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this an issue for you now in your family? Are you having these conversations about end-of-life issues with a parent or a spouse, or maybe on your own behalf? Or Is there something going on where you wish you were talking about it and you don't know how to start? What does planning for a good death look like to you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Samuel Harrington is with us. He's the author of the new book, At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you spent time thinking about and planning for the kind of end of life you'd like to have? What does that mean to you? What does that look like to you? Have you gone through this? Are you going through this with a family member? What kind of questions have come up? What kind of conversations do you wish you'd had by now? Call in at 800-642-1234. And do you think there's too much attention on prolonged medical care at the end of life? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to your calls now. Monica is with us in Waukesha. Hi.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for having this conversation. I think it's very important. I learned from a sad experience. My father's sister and his sister-in-law both died of brain aneurysms. And he was a physician, and he always talked about, what is it merciful for people to keep prolonging life? Well, as it would happen, he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and the only treatment in Mexico was a radical prostatectomy. And he said, absolutely not. I will live with dignity whatever years I have left. And as life would have it, he had a brain aneurysm himself and died.
Monica, thank you for sharing your father's story. So he was faced, in this case, with a diagnosis, a radical treatment, and chose not to do it. How, Sam, do you weigh those? In some cases, yeah, the treatment is the right decision for a person. Sometimes it isn't. How do you weigh the difficulties, the risks of the treatment against the well-being of the patient?
Well, I think that if a treatment doesn't promise to improve the quality of your life while simultaneously prolonging it, then you have to think very hard about that particular treatment, because if you are trading a good day at home for a day of isolation in a hospital, or a good day at home for 2 days of side effects at home, you've entered a zero-sum game. And I didn't get the entire question from the caller, but I heard the word dignity, that he preferred to die with dignity in his own definition of it. And I think that's enormously important to people, to some people, and we have to appreciate that and try and follow their wishes in that regard.
Monica, thanks for your call. We'll go next to Samantha in Whitehall. Samantha, hi.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I like your show. Anyway, I was just saying that I'm 36 years old. When I pass on, I've already have it made known to family members and friends that, you know, it's all laid out that I'm going to be, my body is going to be donated to science, and then it's going to be, used, and then it'll be cremated afterwards so others can use it. And I just wanted to say that they're saying that they need more and more, you know, donors, you know, of bodies, because what do you need it when you're gone? So I just wanted to kind of throw that out there. And what do you think about body donation?
Samantha, thanks for the call. Samantha, going a little later in the equation than you've been talking about, Sam, what happens after we die. Is that something that is important to spell out for family members?
Well, it is important to spell out for family members, and I think her point is an important one. I do not touch on that in my book, but I will say that as a medical student at the University of Wisconsin, I was deeply impressed that a person donated their body for us to learn about gross anatomy, and I am very appreciative of that. So I think it's quite important.
Thanks for the call. I want to turn to another part of your book. You go through some of the most common chronic illnesses facing people over the age of, I think, 65 was the breaking point, and look at the prognosis and the development of diseases and the kind of treatments that are out there. Is that important when we get that diagnosis that we didn't want to start looking in the future, the common progressions of these diseases?
I think it's critically important, and I think that doctors don't tell patients enough about their disease, and patients frequently don't ask enough questions about it, their disease. And I think that knowing one's prognosis is something that patients sometimes avoid and doctors frequently avoid because of the fear of upsetting a patient or seeming too cold and calculating. But I think it's critically important, as I said, when my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, her prognosis was she had a median survival of 10 months. That meant that ultimately 50% of patients in her circumstance would pass away within 10 months. And at an advanced age, you're much less likely to exceed the median. So if you think of yourself as having a finite period of time, then you can make better plans about how you're going to deal with it, including, as my mother did, focusing on going to my daughter's wedding and taking comfort in making it there, for example. But we ignore prognosis too much, and I think it's in the patient's best interest to learn as much as possible.
Is that part of what leads to maybe false hope, as you were talking about earlier? If we don't understand the prognosis, we might look at a treatment and think, oh, maybe this is going to cure something that really isn't going to be cured.
I think it does. I think it does lead to false hope. And I think false hope leads to futile treatment. And I think futile treatment is cruel and wrong. Now, people have a hard time defining medical futility, but I think we know it and we can recognize it in retrospect. Because if we look at the way our loved ones died, if we look at the last treatment our loved one endured before they died, and if we then, on reflection, say to ourselves, I wish I had not done that to my mother. I wish I had not allowed my father to do that aggressive therapy. Well, we've defined futile treatment at that moment, and the trick is to recognize it in advance and avoid it. Which I think with experience, doctors can guide patients in that regard.
Talking to Dr. Samuel Harrington about his new book, At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life. Sam, on a practical note, there are things like do not resuscitate statements and other directives about what kind of care we do and don't want in an emergency situation. What kind of options are out there for people?
Well, there are a variety of advanced directives that people can look at, download, and sort through themselves and come up with their own list of wishes. Specifically, you described do not resuscitate as a form of advanced directive, and pulse orders, physician orders for life-sustaining treatment, are also. When my mother was diagnosed, we determined within a month or two that she would go into hospice care and would be a do not resuscitate patient. And I was very comforted by that because once you can avoid that kind of aggressive treatment, your family member is going to pass away more comfortably than the alternative. After my mother died, my father started to wear his wife's do not resuscitate bracelet, which I told him that's not exactly how we do it, Dad. It's better if you sign up officially. But he did sign up officially about 5 years before he died, and I felt that that was a good decision for him. And we aim for pulse orders for, say, 2 or 3 years before we sort of expect a patient to pass away. Now, obviously, nobody can predict the future. Doctors are not good at that in particular, but we can have a general sense of what a person's prognosis is and adjust our advanced directives accordingly.
Are you hoping to see a mindset, a cultural change in the medical profession when it comes to these end-of-life issues?
I would like to see that. I did have colleagues who refused to discuss prognosis with their patients, and I thought that was quite wrong. and I had colleagues who were overly aggressive, and I thought that was equally wrong. I really think that medical schools and training programs should have a curriculum that includes a course, and I'm making this up, something along the lines of, would you really want your mother to undergo this treatment? And we pay lip service to the mother test, as in, would you let your mother do this? But we shouldn't pay just lip service. We should make it a part of the new mindset.
And are you seeing a change just among people, among patients, families in the United States to start thinking about these issues more? Or is this still a conversation most of us aren't having?
Well, it's definitely a conversation most of us aren't having. It is a... But more of us are having it appropriately, and I hope to push this in from a small wave into a tidal wave.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Harrington, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob, for having me. It's sort of like coming home, being on Wisconsin Public Radio.
It was good to have you back. Thanks so much. That was Dr. Samuel Harrington. He practiced internal medicine and gastroenterology for more than 30 years in Washington, D.C. He grew up in Milwaukee here in Wisconsin, and he's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin Medical School. We've been talking about his new book. It's called At Peace, Choosing a Good Death After a Long Life, looking at a lot of end-of-life issues, the way the medical profession treats seniors, and the way families and patients can have conversations about these issues. Still time for you to share your story. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if this is something you're dealing with in your family.